Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1213, I will have three segments. First, we will listen to the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine and Lebanon. After that, we will listen to Sumaya Awad, a Palestinian writer and co-editor of Palestine, a Socialist Introduction, speaking about how much the U.S. has spent on funding the genocide in Gaza and funding the ongoing Israeli settler colonialism and apartheid in Palestine. During the third segment, we will listen to both Senators Bernie Sanders and Chris Van Hollen making a case on the Senate floor to block the sale of bombs and bulldozers to Israel. Although the efforts failed, it was notable that support for apartheid Israel is shifting after a record 40 senators voted to block the arms sale to Israel. Let's begin with the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine and Lebanon, presented by Noura Burrows-Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Noura Burrows-Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 923 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine and Lebanon. In Gaza, 8 Palestinians were killed and nearly 30 were wounded in Israeli attacks over a 24-hour period between Tuesday and Wednesday, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. On Tuesday night, at least 5 Palestinians were killed in an Israeli strike on the Beach refugee camp in Gaza City. The Electronic Intifada's contributor, photojournalist Mohammed Assad, posted this report to his social media from the funeral march in the beach camp on Wednesday.
There really a ceasefire agreement in Gaza.
There is a false image among the people around the world that ceasefire is in place in Gaza, but in reality, what's happening only reduction of the intensity of the violence. Instead of killing 100 of two or 200 Palestinians in the day, Israeli forces are now killing between 5 and 10 Palestinians daily. The heartbreaking scenes and continuous funerals are happening every day. Children are being killed, women are being killed, and young are being killed. Mothers crying over their children and loved ones, and not an exception. It is a daily reality. This is also happening among the rising tensions in the Middle East, particularly related to the Iran front. As the global attention shifts to other regions, Israeli forces are taking advantage of this and continue to carry out these violations on a daily basis.
That was Mohammed Assad in Gaza. Just hours before Tuesday's attack on the Beach refugee camp, Israel carried out a strike on a vehicle in Gaza City, killing a police officer and 3 bystanders, one of whom was a 3-year-old boy, Yahya al-Malahi. Reporter Saad Hezbollah captured footage of Yahya's father, Mukhlis al-Malahi, in agonizing shock and grief, cradling the body of his toddler whose head is split in half, with blood all over both of their clothes. He told reporters that they were leaving a relative's wedding when an Israeli plane attacked the police car. The boy's cousin told Reuters, quote, "What is his fault? What is his crime? He should be wearing a wedding suit at his cousin's today, but instead he wore a shroud stained with blood." Israeli fire also killed a 14-year-old child, Ahmed Halawa, near Jabalia in the north, according to health ministry officials. On Monday, April 13th, Israeli forces bombed a cafe in Gaza City, targeting Palestinians who were sitting inside. Reporter Mahmoud Shalha covered the scene as people pulled bodies from the rubble by hand. In northern Gaza, 10-year-old Abdullah Dawas was shot in the head and killed by an Israeli quadcopter drone on April 11th, according to reporter Maha Husseini. Husseini said that at least 8 Palestinians had been killed in a series of Israeli attacks across Gaza on Sunday. On April 10th, at least 6 Palestinians were killed in an Israeli airstrike on the Burej refugee camp in central Gaza. The Gaza government media office stated on Tuesday that in the 6 months since the so-called ceasefire was declared, Israel has killed more than 750 Palestinians, injured 2,100, and committed approximately 2,400 violations. Of those violations, Israel has committed more than 1,100 incidents of shelling and targeted strikes, hundreds of incidents involving the demolition of homes and other buildings, and nearly 100 incursions into residential neighborhoods and areas. Meanwhile, Israel continues to use food, medicine, medical supplies, and fuel as weapons, with its draconian blockade of humanitarian aid firmly in place. The Gaza government media office affirmed this week that Gaza is, quote, being subjected to a systematic, deliberate, and escalating process of engineered starvation perpetrated by the Israeli occupation. This is being executed through the complete control of the flow of basic commodities, foremost among them flour and bread, thereby posing a direct threat to the food security of the people in the Gaza Strip. Gaza requires around 450 tons of flour per day, the office stated, but only about 200 tons are currently available, quote, creating a severe daily deficit. Despite the ceasefire agreement, which requires 600 aid trucks per day, only around 200 have been allowed in on average, leaving shelter supplies, medical aid, and food items almost non-existent, reports Maha Husseini in Middle East Eye. This comes on the heels of a claim made by Nikolai Mladenov, envoy to Donald Trump's Board of Peace, that 602 trucks entered Gaza on April 9th, quote, with essential supplies for families who have waited too long. Mladenov's statement, the Gaza media office said, quote, lacks accuracy and credibility, and it contradicts documented facts on the ground. Actual data for April 9th, 2026, confirms the entry of only 207 trucks, 79 of which were aid trucks. This falls far short of the required level of humanitarian response and in no way reflects expanded access, as was alleged, particularly given that the rate of compliance with truck entry protocols since the commencement of the ceasefire has not exceeded 38% of the agreed-upon target. The media office noted that Mladenov's deliberate misinformation, quote, raises fundamental questions. Where is the so-called Board of Peace amidst the Israeli occupation's daily violations of the agreement? Why does it remain silent? And furthermore, where does it stand regarding the public pledges it made before the international community to protect the Gaza Strip in light of a catastrophic and worsening humanitarian reality? Medical Aid for Palestinians, a British charity, this week warned of the ongoing shortages of basic medications and medical supplies across Gaza. More than 53% of essential medicines are at zero stock, medical workers say, including 64% of cancer medications. Around 70% of medical laboratories have stopped functioning because of the lack of supplies, and 90 hospital generators are out of service due to spare parts and oil being blocked by Israel. Medical Aid for Palestinians says that approximately half of all hospitals remain non-functional, and there are still no fully functional hospitals in Gaza at all. MAP says that their teams, quote, can't find even the essential medicines they need. That says everything about how aid is coming in. Euromed Human Rights Monitor released a comprehensive report this week on Israel's de facto state policy of sexual violence against Palestinians in Israeli prisons and detention centers. The report, titled Another Genocide Behind Walls, documents widespread patterns of sexual violence, including rape, against detainees from the Gaza Strip describing it as a tool of destruction aimed at breaking individual and collective will and inflicting severe physical and psychological harm. And just a note to our listeners, the following excerpts from the report contain descriptions of sexual violence. The report cites direct sexual assault, assault with objects, and torture targeting the genitals, as well as organized practices such as filming and the presence of multiple security personnel during assaults, which reinforces evidence of the institutional and systematic nature of these crimes. The report, Euromed adds, quote, relied primarily on live testimonies from Palestinian former detainees from the Gaza Strip who were released by Israeli forces in recent weeks and months and who reported being subjected to various forms of systematic sexual violence. Testimonies documented by the group, quote, confirm that forcing prisoners and detainees to witness sexual violence against others in Israeli detention centers was a frequent and deliberate practice. This formed part of psychological abuse and complex torture designed to create a collective impact, turn the victim's body into a tool for terrorizing detainees, break their will, and produce collective helplessness. In this context, rape and sexual assault were not only committed in secret, but in documented cases, were staged as a public spectacle in courtyards and shared cells. Detainees were forced to line up or remain within direct view while others were assaulted, making the act of witnessing itself a structural component of the crime rather than a mere circumstance. This practice consisted of repeated collective humiliation rituals designed to dehumanize detainees in front of each other. Techniques included collective forced nudity, crowding detainees naked, using obscenities, and breaching social norms, such as stripping men in front of women and children, or threatening women with rape while their husbands watched. The goal was to break family bonds and create a sense of helplessness, impacting both the victims and the witnesses. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces fired tear gas at a group of children trying to get to their school in Masafariyata, south of Al-Khalil, on April 13th. Mohamed Horeini, a resident of Masafariyata and an activist, recorded a rampage by Jewish Israeli settlers into his village of Tuani on April 13th. He said, "Settlers stormed lands in my village, Tuani, in Masafariyata, bringing their sheep onto our property under the full view of the Israeli army and police. Palestinians were forcibly driven off their own land, while settlers were allowed to roam freely without any restraint. As if this was not enough, they escalated the violence by firing tear gas and stun grenades directly at us. To make matters worse, one of the residents was arrested simply in response to the settlers' demands. This is not just harassment. It is a systematic policy of intimidation and dispossession carried out in broad daylight with complete impunity." That's from Mohamed Horeini in Masafariyata. Meanwhile, my colleague Tamara Nassar reports this week that Israel is establishing facts on the ground in the occupied West Bank faster than ever before. She writes that, quote, in March, Israel's so-called security cabinet covertly approved the establishment of 34 new settlements, not units, entire settlements in the West Bank. News of this decision only became public last week after being kept confidential by the cabinet when it was approved, reportedly in an effort to avoid backlash from the United States during negotiations for a ceasefire with Iran. This is Israel's largest ever colonial expansion, said Francesca Albanese, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, on April 9th. This is the largest ethnic cleansing and land grab in Palestine since the Nakba. It's happening under our watch, she continued. Tamara notes that before the current government took power in 2022, there were 127 recognized Israeli settlements in the West Bank, according to the Israeli group Peace Now, which monitors settlement activity. The newly approved 34 settlements would add to 68 that the government has already advanced since its formation, bringing the total number of settlements approved under this administration to 102, Peace Now added. This is roughly an 80% increase of all settlements in the West Bank advanced under this government alone. These developments are taking place against a backdrop of accelerating settler violence against Palestinians in the West Bank, Tamara writes. At least 37 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank so far in 2026, at least 10 of them by settlers. Tamara adds that, quote, whether through de facto or de jure annexation, the Israeli objective has always been the same. The underlying logic of Zionism, as it is with any colonial movement, is the expansion of settlements and the displacement of the indigenous population to replace them with colonial settlers. Every Israeli front, whether in Gaza, the West Bank, or elsewhere, is ultimately rooted in that objective, Tamara writes. For much more, read Tamara Nassar's report, Israel's Largest Land Grab Since the Nakba, on electronicintifada.net. Turning to Lebanon, Israeli attacks across the country have killed more than 2,100 people and have injured approximately 7,000 since March 2nd. A week ago, on April 8th, as we reported, Israel hit Beirut in a barrage of strikes that killed more than 300 people within minutes. Speaking to Al-Mayadeen, Dr. Ghassan Abusitta, who is currently working in the hospital at the American University of Beirut, said that Israel's attacks were deliberately designed to overwhelm the country's healthcare system and maximize deaths. The following is from Al-Mayadeen's report. Quote, in a period of 10 minutes, over 1,400 people were wounded and 340 were killed, Abusitta said. The aim is to flood the system, to overwhelm it, and to ensure that as many of the wounded die. He said that the scale and speed of the strikes collapsed emergency response capacity from the outset, leaving ambulance services and hospitals unable to cope with the volume of casualties. Hospitals rapidly exhausted intensive care capacity, including pediatric units, while smaller facilities were forced to transfer patients under life-threatening delays. Quote, we ran out of intensive care beds. We ran out of pediatric intensive care capacity, he said. The smaller hospitals were overwhelmed, and the delays in transferring patients cost lives. That day was the first day that felt like a day in Gaza's Al-Shifa hospital, he said. Children came in with no names, no surviving families. Nobody knew who anybody was. The scenes, he added, triggered immediate psychological recall. You find yourself thinking, not this again. For more on the aftermath of the April 8th attacks and the current situation in Lebanon, our contributor Rokaya Chemsedine filed this report for the Electronic Intifada on Wednesday evening.
I'm Rokaya Chemsedine reporting for the Electronic Intifada. It has been 1 week since what has come to be known as Black Wednesday, a devastating Israeli assault that in the span of roughly 10 minutes killed more than 300 people across Beirut and its southern suburbs. The coordinated wave of strikes carved through densely populated neighborhoods, marking one of the bloodiest days in Lebanon's recent history. As of this recording, dozens are still missing and believed to be trapped beneath the rubble, while at least 15 unidentified bodies remain in refrigerated units at Rafiq al-Hariri University Hospital in Beirut, a stark and ongoing testament to the scale of devastation. In the southern Lebanese city of Bint Jbin, Hezbollah resistance fighters continue to mount a fierce defense against ongoing Israeli attempts to seize the strategically significant location, engaging invading forces in sustained close-range confrontations that have reportedly resulted in mounting losses. Local sources describe near daily helicopter evacuations from the outskirts of the city, with Israeli troops being transported north towards medical facilities across the border, including Rambam Medical Center and occupied Haifa. In other areas of South Lebanon, first responders continue to face Israeli airstrikes, including most recently in the town of Mayfalun, where three paramedics, Fed al-Sarhan, Mahdi Abu Zaid and Ali Sabra, were killed after their ambulances were intentionally targeted by Israeli forces as they attempted to tend to a previous Israeli attack. Also this week, even as Israel continues to attack towns across southern Lebanon and kill dozens of Lebanese citizens, Lebanese government representatives sat across from Israeli officials in Washington in what was presented as a peace initiative brokered by U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio. The meeting brought together Lebanon's ambassador Neda Mu'awad and Israeli envoy Yechiel Leiter, marking a rare direct engagement, but one that unfolded under the shadow of ongoing bombardment. The shared demands of the meeting reportedly centered on the disarmament of Hezbollah and the imposition of a new security reality in the south, effectively stripping Lebanon of its only meaningful line of defense. The timing and substance of these talks have provoked sharp backlash on the ground, where they are widely viewed as capitulation and as an effort by the Lebanese political class to do through negotiations what cannot be achieved on the battlefield, that is, to forcibly strip Hezbollah of its right to resist and thereby dismantle the country's only credible deterrent against Israeli aggression. As resistance fighters continue to confront Israeli forces in places like Bint Jbeil, the contrast is stark. A government engaging in negotiations from a position of weakness while the battlefield itself continues to impose limits on Israeli advances.
That was Rokaya Chemsedine reporting for the Electronic Intifada from Lebanon on Wednesday. We've published many features in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Women Recount Abuse at Hands of Israeli Military by Ahud Nassar, writing from Gaza. Nassar profiles two women, Sharifa Kudih and Saja Abdel-Al, who she says reveal some of what women have endured during Israeli military incursions into Gaza's neighborhoods, a trajectory that begins but does not end with airstrikes and displacement. In a narrow corridor inside a government school that has been converted into a shelter in the city of Khan Yunus in Gaza's south, Sharifa Kudih, 50, sits on a piece of cardboard while families pass endlessly around her. Unmarried and with no children to care for, this corridor is all that remains, she said, after her home in the town of Abasan al-Kabira, east of Khan Yunus, was destroyed. In February 2024, Sharifa said, around 5:30 a.m., she was asleep in her home when it was bombed. I woke up to a massive explosion and then found myself under the rubble, she said. She was not badly injured, but was trapped beneath the debris for nearly 2 hours before invading Israeli troops heard her and pulled her out. When they took me out, I thought I was going to die or be taken prisoner, she said. Instead, she told the Electronic Intifada, the soldiers ordered her to remove her hijab, the scarf covering her hair, and tied her hands. Then they questioned her. They asked me why I was in the house and about names of people. I didn't know any of them. Soldiers sat her on a chair on her own devastated land as they continued their operations. Sharifa said the soldiers then used her as a human shield alongside a group of young men. They forced us to walk in front of them, she said. Human rights organizations have documented hundreds of cases in which the Israeli military broke international law, including using women and children as human shields. Photos were taken of Sharifa while she was seated on a chair on a mound of earth with Israeli soldiers crouching behind her, apparently combat ready. She only discovered this later when an Israeli soldier received an award for the photo, which was apparently taken by drone, and said she gave no consent and was not asked for any. I was shocked when acquaintances sent me a photo of myself displayed in a gallery in Tel Aviv. I had no idea they had photographed me. After the soldiers finished with her, they let her go, a surveillance drone monitoring her from above, she said. She had to walk over rubble for more than an hour to get away from the area and to safety. Sharifa now lives in the corridor of the government school in Khan Yunus. She has neither a mattress nor a blanket. She sleeps like she sits on a piece of cardboard that was distributed as humanitarian aid. Her home was completely destroyed, and she has nowhere else to go. Those are excerpts from Women Recount Abuse at Hands of Israeli Military by Ahud Nassar, a journalist and teacher writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and reclamation across Palestine and around the world. Photographer Samer Abu Samra captured video of a volleyball game in northern Gaza this week. Abu Samra writes, quote, "In the Jabalia refugee camp at the Abu Hussein school and on the yellow line, from the school's rubble, we make life. We play and dream, and we believe that hope is not defeated." And two children in Gaza, Mira and Ahed, whose parents post videos of them on social media, sang a love song to their sweet tea with mint. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. On Tax Day in the United States, April 15, 2026, Democratic Socialists of America organized an online public event titled No Money for War, Tax Day 2026. There were several speakers at that event, and I'm going to share now the remarks delivered by Sumaya Awad, a Palestinian writer, co-editor of Palestine, a Socialist Introduction. She is also a member of the New York City Democratic Socialists of America. She spoke about how much the U.S. has spent on funding the genocide in Gaza and funding the ongoing Israeli settler colonialism and apartheid in Palestine. Let's take a listen.
What I want to start with is just how much the U.S. Has spent on funding the genocide in Gaza and on funding Israeli settler colonialism and apartheid in Palestine. Since October of 2023, the U.S. government, first under Biden and then under Trump, has sent over $30 billion in military funding to Israel to enact the genocide, to fund the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians across Palestine and the occupied West Bank, as well as in Gaza. And in the last year, Trump has also bypassed congressional approval to send an extra $650 million more to Israel. And many of these weapons that are being sent, they are U.S. manufactured weapons. So they also prop up the U.S. weapons industry, which is then also used on our streets by ICE agents, by the Department of Homeland Security, by various police forces across the country. We are now also engaged in more wars. We have war against Iran. We are continuing to fund Israel as it bombs Lebanon. And there is a regional war brewing in the Middle East that we have both feet in. In the first 2 weeks of the war on Iran, the estimates are that the U.S. spent $2.1 billion a day on the war. And these are lower estimates. Some say the estimates are much, much higher. This is a war that that only 20% of Americans support. And when it comes to Israel, 60% of Americans have said they support an arms embargo. They support stopping the shipment of weapons to Israel. And still we hear the same excuses again and again from our government and by successive governments that we go to war in order to either defend ourselves here, that it is a form of defense, or to free others overseas. Both of those are so false, and we've seen it again and again, that working class people actually pay the price for all the wars that our governments wage. We see that with the working class people in Iran paying the price, in Lebanon, of course, across Palestine, and across the region in the Middle East. And then we see what it does here in the US, where it is working class people that pay the price for the wars our government is waging abroad. I actually want to quote Trump from a recent press conference, because at a time where most working class Americans are really suffering and are unable to pay for healthcare, unable to pay rent, or unable to pay for groceries, etc. At a press conference, Donald Trump was asked about this, and he said, quote, "The United States can't take care of daycare. We have all these people. We're fighting wars. We can't take care of daycare, Medicare, Medicaid, all these individual needs, end quote. So it is very blatant. He's saying the quiet part that's usually quiet out loud, that in fact we are spending on wars, we are spending on a bloated military budget, a bloated DHS budget, a bloated Pentagon budget, while we can't afford to give the basic needs of what working class Americans need every day. In fact, just $12 billion, which is a fraction of what the U.S. sends, what the U.S. has sent to Israel over the course of decades, $12 billion could fund the following. It could fund nearly $2 million of family groceries for 1 year. It could fund over 300,000 plus students, just fully fund their student debt, get rid of their student debt. And it could fund $3.5 million dollars worth of healthcare for children in this country. And that is just a fraction of what that amount is, $12 billion, when you think about the dozens of billions of dollars that this government continues to send Israel over decades, and especially in the last 3 years, 2.5 years since the genocide has begun. And that spending is ongoing, regardless of a quote-unquote ceasefire, which we know is not real. I mean, the bombs on Lebanon continue to fall. Just last week, Israel in 10 minutes bombed 100 different targets in Lebanon. And this was during a so-called ceasefire. During multiple rounds of ceasefires in Gaza, the bombs kept falling. Palestinians kept paying the price. And all of this was funded by the U.S. All of this was funded by our very own tax dollars. And so it's so important, and I can't underscore this enough, that we say that we want to end military funding to Israel, to end this bloated Pentagon military budget. And there's so many ways to do that. And fighting for an arms embargo can manifest in many, many ways. And one of them that is so important is the Block the Bombs Act, which is a piece of legislation in Congress with a list of members growing, supporting it every day. But the pressure, we need to keep the pressure on, especially when talks of ceasefire happen and people think, oh, this is going to end. That is especially when we need to keep the pressure on, because we know that these are false negotiations. We know that the reality on the ground is that people keep dying. We know that the military funding is going to continue, and that the genocide will continue until we're able to say both end U.S. funding, military funding to Israel, and U.S. military funding to all these wars abroad, which, by the way, come back home on our streets. And we're seeing that with ICE agents just roaming our streets. But it's also important to highlight that it's not just the military funding that we need to end, but it's also the diplomatic immunity and cover that the U.S. provides Israel every single year. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
That was Sumaya Awad, a Palestinian writer, co-editor of Palestine, a Socialist Introduction, and a member of the New York City Democratic Socialists of America, speaking at an event organized by Democratic Socialists of America. You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Speaking of spending U.S. tax dollars to fund wars and genocide, U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders for Vermont introduced resolutions for the fourth time to block arms sales to Israel. Although the resolutions failed again on this last round, it was notable that a record 40 senators voted in favor of blocking arms sales to Israel. I'm going to share now a portion of the remarks delivered on the Senate floor on April 16, 2026, by Senator Bernie Sanders, making the case to block the sales of arms to Israel. Let's listen to some of his remarks.
Israel did not have the right to violate international law and wage an all-out war of unspeakable destruction against the entire Palestinian people in what experts have correctly concluded is a genocide. Israel did not have the right, out of a population of 2.2 million, to kill more than 72,000 Palestinians in Gaza and wound over 170,000. That is more than 10% of the population. If that happened here in America, that would be over 30 million Americans dead or wounded. And in Gaza, a strong majority of the dead and wounded are women, children, and the elderly. And by the way, that number is likely an underestimate as to the tragedy, as bodies are literally being pulled out of the rubble every single day. Mr. President, Israel did not have the right to destroy virtually all of Gaza's infrastructure, including its water and sewer systems and its supply of electricity. They did not have the right to demolish every one of Gaza's 12 universities, along with hundreds of schools, dismantling their entire educational system. Vast majority of the children in Gaza today are not in school. Israel did not have the right to indiscriminately bomb civilian neighborhoods and damage or destroy over 90% of the housing units in Gaza, over 90% damaged or destroyed, resulting in the vast majority of the population there now sleeping in tents. That is where they are today. Israel did not have the right to bomb over 90% of the hospitals in Gaza, hospitals, and kill 1,700 healthcare workers. And Mr. President, Israel did not have the right to impose a blockade which prevented food, water, and medicine from entering Gaza, resulting in thousands of Palestinians being diagnosed with malnutrition and hundreds actually starving to death. But, Mr. President, today we're not just talking about Gaza. In the West Bank, in direct violation of international law that protects Palestinian territory, Israeli soldiers and settlers since October 2023 have killed over 1,000 Palestinians, including 233 children. During that period, Mr. President, they have demolished more than 6,000 Palestinian homes and established more than 200 new illegal settlements and outposts in Palestinian territory. And let us be clear, because I think there is some confusion about this. These actions are not just the results of some extremists out of control settlers who are just doing whatever they want. Those actions are consistent with Israeli government policy. Netanyahu's security cabinet has approved the most sweeping changes to the West Bank's legal status since 1967, removing nearly all constraints on settlement expansion. Netanyahu himself declared, this is Netanyahu, quote, "There will never be a Palestinian state," end quote. And I say that to some people here who still say, well, we're in favor of a two-state solution. That is not Mr. Netanyahu's position. Quote, he said, "There will never be a Palestinian state." His finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, bragged that new settlement construction in the West Bank would bury, that's his word, bury the idea of a Palestinian state. But, Mr. President, it is not just Gaza and the West Bank. We now know that Netanyahu convinced President Trump to start an unprovoked and unconstitutional war on Iran. For 40 years, Netanyahu has wanted the United States to participate with Israel in a war against Iran, and finally, after 40 years of effort, he finally found in Trump a president willing to go along. He couldn't get Democratic presidents in the past, couldn't get Republican presidents in the past. in Trump, he finally found a president willing to go along. This war in violation of international law has resulted already in the deaths of thousands of civilians, including hundreds of children in Iran and Lebanon, including 26 Israeli civilians who are now dead, and 13 American soldiers who have lost their lives so far in this conflict. Mr. President, all over the world, certainly including the United States, hundreds of millions of innocent people are suffering the economic consequences of this war, with higher prices and growing scarcity of basic goods. I believe that in Vermont now, the price of gas, regular gas, is about $4 a gallon. Parts of the country, it is even higher than that. But Mr. President, for Netanyahu, Gaza was not enough. Attacking Iran was not enough. Netanyahu is now waging a full-blown war of expansion against Lebanon. That war in Lebanon has not only killed more than 2,000 people, but has resulted in Israel occupying 14% of Lebanese territory. Let me repeat that. The war in Lebanon has not only killed more than 2,000 people, but has resulted in Israel occupying 14% of Lebanese territory. Mr. President, the Israeli Defense Minister, Israel Katz, has announced that all Lebanese border villages will be demolished. Will be demolished. His exact words, following, quote, the model in Gaza. They're going to demolish border villages. Bezalel Smotrich, the finance minister, has warned that Dayaya, a suburb of South Beirut, quote, will look like Khan Yunis, end quote, a city in Gaza that Israel reduced to rubble. In other words, what they did in parts, what they did in Gaza is now what they intend to do in parts of Lebanon. And these, Mr. President, are not threats. They are promises. For all of the reasons that I have given, and more, and you're going to hear more from some of my colleagues in a few moments, support for Israel in this country has plummeted. Today, according to a recent Pew poll, 80% of Democrats now have an unfavorable opinion of Israel, and 41% of Republicans share that view. And the numbers in all parties among young people are even higher. Young people, whether they are young Democrats, progressives, conservatives, do not want us to continue to fund the horrific war policies of Netanyahu. A recent Quinnipiac poll also found that 60%, including three-quarters of Democrats, two-thirds of independents, and 37% of Republicans. I say that to my Republican colleagues. 37% of Republicans do not want the U.S. sending more military aid to Israel. And that is why, Mr. President, I am offering today two joint resolutions of disapproval, the only formal mechanism Congress has to block an arms sale. The first resolution would block the sale of $151 million in 1,000-pound bombs. The second would block $295 million in bulldozers, the machines used to demolish homes in the West Bank and Gaza, and make a Palestinian state physically impossible. Mr. President, the time is long overdue for members of the U.S. Senate to start listening to the American people and not to AIPAC. The time is now for us to end all U.S. military aid to the extremist Netanyahu government, and a yes vote is an important way forward.
That was U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders speaking on the Senate floor on April 16, 2026, making a case to block arms sales to Israel. U.S. Senator Chris Van Hollen for Maryland also spoke on the Senate floor to block arms sales to Israel. Let's listen to some of his remarks.
The Netanyahu government is not justified in imposing collective punishment on all the people of Gaza. As Senator Merkley and I wrote in our report after traveling to the region in August 2025, and I quote, the Netanyahu government is implementing a plan to ethnically cleanse Gaza of Palestinians. America is complicit. And now, as Senator Sanders indicated, Israeli leaders are saying out loud they plan to apply the same plans in southern Lebanon as they implemented in Gaza. Senator Sanders mentioned threatening what they did in Khan Yunis. As recently as March 31st, Israeli Defense Minister Katz said that, and I quote, all homes in Lebanese villages near the border will be destroyed in accordance with the Rafah and Beit Hanun model in Gaza, unquote. Well, colleagues, I visited Gaza. I visited the Gaza crossing, the Rafah crossing twice, along with my colleague, Senator Merkley. First in January 2024, when Rafah's population had quadrupled from pre-war levels to more than 1 million people who'd been displaced within Gaza, from northern Gaza. And then we traveled to the Rafah crossing in August 2025. After the IDF's offensive against Rafah, one that the Biden administration claimed that they tried to stop. And on that visit, Senator Merkley and I climbed a rooftop, and you could look into Rafah, obliterated, reduced to absolute rubble. And as we were told by former IDF soldiers, eyewitnesses who had the courage to speak with us, Israel has systematically dismantled essential infrastructure and wrought near total destruction of the civilian sites throughout Gaza, including through the use of these bulldozers and 100,000-pound bombs. And now the Israeli Minister of Defense says they're going to do the same thing in southern Lebanon. And indeed, since the war in Lebanon restarted, Israeli forces have killed over 2,000 people, including 250 people in 10 minutes the day after the ceasefire was announced. Entire villages have been destroyed and over 1.1 million people displaced. Now, let's not forget how we got in to this most recent round of destruction in the region. President Trump is fully responsible for getting America into this war, period. But we know from Trump administration officials and public reporting how Prime Minister Netanyahu, for his own reasons, was pushing Trump to attack Iran. Indeed, he said it himself. On April 11th, Netanyahu boasted to the Israeli public that Israel was, quote, first to act because we knew what was at stake. But if I had told you a year ago that our pilots, men and women, would fly in Iran, who would have believed it? Said Prime Minister Netanyahu. Went on to say, if I had told you a year ago that the United States of America, the strongest power in the world, would fight by our side, shoulder to shoulder, wing to wing, for nearly 40 days against the common enemy, who would have believed it? And then Prime Minister Netanyahu went on to say, all this happened because we initiated, we acted, we attacked, unquote. Now, those of us who have been around here a little while know that Prime Minister Netanyahu has been pushing for a war with Iran for a very long time. In fact, he recently publicly acknowledged that the current U.S.-Israel war on Iran, quote, allows us to do what I've been hoping to do for 40 years. That's what Prime Minister Netanyahu said. I remember when Prime Minister Netanyahu actually presided spoke before a joint session of Congress asking us not to support the JCPOA, which of course prevented Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. Of course, the current president then tore that up when he first came into office. So Prime Minister Netanyahu has been trying to get previous presidents to join him in attacking Iran, but no previous president was stupid enough or reckless enough to actually do it. And so here we are. Without facing any imminent threat, President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu started an illegal war against Iran. And it is a gross violation of international law. Indeed, on April 2nd, a group of over 100 international law experts, people who actually believe in international law, included former U.S. and U.N. officials, published an open letter stating, quote, the initiation of the campaign was a clear violation of the United Nations Charter, and that the conduct of the United States and Israeli forces in the war, quote, raises serious concerns about violations of international human rights and international humanitarian law, including potential war crimes. That's on top of the illegality of initiating a war against Iran. Now look, earlier this afternoon, nearly all Democrats voted together to end Donald Trump's illegal war against Iran. Many of us have vowed that we will not support one taxpayer dollar to continue this war that's making us less safe and less well off. Well, that commitment and determination should apply to the Trump administration and to the Netanyahu administration. We need to rein in Trump in this illegal war, and we need to rein in the Netanyahu administration in this illegal war. Now, colleagues, I want to focus for a moment on the portion of the Sanders resolution that bans the transfer of bulldozers to the IDF. These are the bulldozers that helped raise Rafah in Gaza to the ground. And for those who don't remember, I asked them to recall the case of Rachel Khoury, a 23-year-old American peace activist who was killed by an Israeli bulldozer trying to block the raising of buildings in Rafah over 20 years ago. Rachel Khoury has never gotten any justice, and her family will tell you that today. In fact, just since January of 2022, at least 9 more American citizens have been killed by extremist Israeli settlers or security forces in the West Bank. And not one of them, not one, has gotten justice. Just like Rachel Khoury, no accountability. Now, Mr. President, there's no piece of equipment that has helped Israel and Netanyahu government destroy civilian infrastructure in the West Bank and Gaza, and now Lebanon, more than the bulldozer. Just look at the titles of some of the reporting coming from what's happening about southern Lebanon. Guardian title, everything's gone. Israel destroys entire villages. And you can see it for yourself. I really encourage my colleagues just to look at the videos. Some of them have been shared by members of the Israeli military themselves that showed controlled detonations and destruction of entire villages. And this isn't new. During the last war in Lebanon, Amnesty International documented how the Israeli military carried out extensive and deliberate destruction of civilian property across almost the entire Lebanese border with Israel, including 10,000 structures, primarily through the use of manually laid explosives and bulldozers. And in the West Bank, as we speak, we're seeing violent Israeli settlers kill Palestinian citizens with impunity. And we're also seeing the use of these bulldozers to demolish Palestinian homes in the West Bank and other civilian infrastructures. Again, you can see it for yourselves in the videos. This is all part of a slow-motion ethnic cleansing effort in the West Bank and de facto annexation of the West Bank. Indeed, the New York Times in September 2024 spoke about raids in the West Bank villages of Tulkarm and Jenin. The headline was this, quote, "Israeli bulldozers flatten mile after mile in the West Bank," end quote. In total, since the Gaza war started, Israeli authorities have demolished at least 4,900 structures in the West Bank and displaced 9,000 Palestinians there. And as this has gone on, so has settler violence, often with the complicity of the IDF in the West Bank. Over 1,000 Palestinians, including 230 children, have been killed with virtual impunity since October 2023. And with impunity, the Israeli human rights organization Yesh Din said that between 2005 and December 2025, that's a 20-year period, more than 93% of police investigations into settler violence in the West Bank concluded without an indictment. So what are we going to do about this, Mr. President? We need to stop providing the Netanyahu government with an absolute blank check. We need to demand accountability for American citizens who have been killed there.
That was U.S. Senator Chris Van Hollen for Maryland speaking on the Senate floor on April 16, 2026, making a case to block arms sales to Israel. Again, although the resolutions introduced by Senator Bernie Sanders failed to pass, it is worth mentioning that a record 40 senators voted in favor of blocking arms sales to Israel. You've been listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the U.S. and Europe since 2002. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.